Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the All In Crypto Show. Today, we have a very special guest coming on to talk to us about some of his views on the markets. Amongst other things, we have Mr. Hugh Hendry, the founder of The Acid Capitalist, something that I'm personally a fan of, and I listen regularly to this and him delivering his verdict on the markets, amongst other things, a contrarian investor and analyzer, I would say. And also the former founder of a global macro fund. So welcome on board, Hugh. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
It is with trepidation that I present myself to you and your tribe. And I'm thinking, like, maybe you have to change the name of the organization. Cryptos have become like a bad word.
Yeah, a bad word to some, but not to everyone. I mean, it really depends. We know the SEC have certainly brandish crypto is a bit of a bad word recently with their lawsuits against obviously Binance and Coinbase. I think crypto is too much of a kind of broad phrase to summarize everything that's going on with the blockchain movement, but I'm sure we'll get into some of your thoughts on crypto a little bit later on. So again, massive thank you for having you on, for you coming on, Hugh. My followers are certainly fans of yours. And I always like to start off with my guests with a little bit about themselves. You know, how did it start for you and how did you get into the financial markets?
Serendipity. You know, you look back on over the course of your life and there are important pivot points. And I can only explain it as I've got some guardian angel that's looking after me. You know, Madonna with her Kabbalah, kind of getting into that nonsense. You know, and I think I'm probably widely off the mark, but the idea is, like, way back in time, God sent some kind of Navy SEAL angels down to earth to kind of just look after the local folk. And the angels are like, Jesus, like, you know, the women folk down here are really hot, and they ended up having babies.
Are we talking about the Nephilim here, are we?
Yeah. And then God's like, he pulled them back, you know, he's like, no, come back, you're disrupting. And so there are some four standard deviation people out there. Madonna would be one. Obviously, Steve Jobs would be one. Elon Musk would be one. And I'm certainly not one. But maybe I've got a little bit of that blood. And so, you know, people say, where are you from? Which I never like that. Like, from is just such a challenging word for me. I'm from the future, you know. But I was born in Glasgow. I was born under very, very modest circumstances, lived in a, if you will, the Americans would call it a project. It was violent. Our family were kind of not accepted. I guess we were do-gooders on the rise. My father was a truck driver. I was the first, I don't know, it's really hard to explain, but from a very early age, I was willing to sacrifice being a teenager in order to kind of try and develop education to give me escape speed velocity to just get out of Dodge. And a few things happened along the way. I got a position as an investment analyst working in Edinburgh with an incredible company. And 8 years later, I got to London and I finally hooked up with a hedge fund. I mean, no one knew what hedge funds were at the turn of the century. And you look back and you say, well, you know, what happened? So I can only say serendipity. But, you know, so here I am. I had 15 years of tenure. That's T-E-N-U-R-E. I endured. I managed a global macro fund. And it's, think of it more in the style of, I guess, a Spitznagel type fund in the sense of I was the diversifier. I mean, you know, look at me. You know, I'm not a banker. And because of that, I saw that my setup was different. I didn't speak to the street. I wasn't looking for the edge. I wasn't looking for a guy to call me. But I listened to music. I looked at charts. I understood stuff. I could conceive of. My notion was to conceive of contentious narratives that could go on and become an accepted belief system. Yeah, and as they became accepted, I would monetize. I'd make money from being the prophet. I looked in the early stages to wealthy family patrons, if you will, who wanted to sponsor my notion of what might happen. And that was, you know, that was my business. I, like I say, 15 years up until 2017, but by kind of 2013, I was thinking you didn't really need the diversification. You didn't need the insurance because it just felt, I mean, the S&P was 1500. And I was just like, this sucker's just going up. And so I kind of just didn't feel there was a role for me within that universe. And after 4 years, the clients agreed and we parted. I had coincidentally been building at this macro project, which kind of overlaps with your world of crypto. So I fell in love with the most dope, beautiful island in the Caribbean. It's called St. Barts. I do not like the Caribbean. The Caribbean sucks. You typically go there, you stay in compounds, barricaded from the locals because it's sketchy and it can be dangerous. St. Barts is not that. It's like being in Saint-Tropez. There is no crime. And you stay in villas and wonderful hotels, beautiful beaches. The wonder, there's something redemptive about beautiful places. And 15, 30 years of active risk management, my mind was quite, you convince your mind you're going to metaphorically die. And the mind doesn't know. The mind sits there in a black chamber. It doesn't see anything. It trusts on these words coming in. And you say, I'm going to die. It starts flooding you with toxic chemicals, the fight or flight. And so, after a while, that was exhausting. So the island very much was redemptive. But what it offered was the opportunity to buy land. And the island, think of it, if LVMH, so what do? They do luggage, they do haute couture, blah, blah, blah. If they did islands, they would do St. Barts because it's like uber rich, it's very ultra luxe. And there's always someone in the world making it. Like, there's been a lot of your bros suddenly going from like nothing, going, wow, I got money. And when you got money, you kind of, as a peacock thing, you want to go somewhere and go, hey, look at me, I'm with your tribe. So St. Barts is one of those places, a little bit like your halving concept. Every few years, the planners come in and they restrict and they're really trying to control the amount of development. So what I built and opened in 2015, it's impossible to do today. So it's getting scarcer. And of course, we live in a world where everyone has this fiat concern. And then finally, I had two macro hedges. I was receiving revenues in dollars. My costs were in euros. And I liked that kind of cross FX exposure. And secondly, I was financing in euros, fixing at 2%. And I was fixing for 20 years. And again, I like that construct as I look to the future. So that's me, long story. But despite being on a beautiful island, I still have these voices. I still see our political and our monetary leaders making errors. And now I've discovered Twitter, @Hendry_Hugh. And I'm out there taking people down, but not just that, that's negative. I'm trying to give an insight. It's almost like I'm doing a virtual hedge fund and people who follow me kind of become like my analysts. I ask questions, I ask for charts, and I give my views. So that's me.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And I do think you are from the future, Hugh, and certainly back then, because your stereotypical person interested in the financial world, perhaps back then didn't look like you, but at this stage in life, more and more does. I feel like finance has become a more inclusive world where actually you don't need to wear a suit to be a part of it. And perhaps you were a pioneer in that kind of field.
Well, a little bit. I mean, I think definitely, in these new ventures, which I guess like, where you are, that's certainly the case. But believe me, I had to leave a hell of a lot of money on the table being me. I was watching the Baz Luhrmann Elvis movie the other day. And when he's shaking his hips and moving like a black Southern man and all these grotesque white conservatives are trying to close him down. And thankfully, we live less and less in a world like that. But if that conservatism still exists, it's in Wall Street. I'm like one of the top damn brains in macro finance. I can't get a gig anywhere. I should be on, like, if you're managing like a $5 billion hedge fund, doing macro. You'd think you would have me, you'd have me doing I'd come in and we do the quarterly asset allocation. Can't do it. Do you know why they can't do it? Because they need some middle-aged, fat, unhealthy looking guy wearing a suit and a tie. And apparently he worked for some, you know, like a blue chip company, and therefore he gives them credibility. The world sucks.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think it's very honorable of you to be a man that lives on his feet and not his knees. You know, there's that saying out there that, you know, would you rather live on your feet or die on your knees? And what you're saying about people in a suit that have credentials, Goldman Sachs, I always see this get thrown around. Oh, I'm an ex-Goldman Sachs employee. I don't think that quite counts for maybe what it did years ago. I've certainly seen a lot of bad takes from ex-Goldman Sachs employees. And I absolutely love your takes. I think that you've got an amazing understanding of what's going on here on a really deep level, certainly in regards to monetary policy, the monetary system as a whole, and the kind of constraints of it. And I really do appreciate your take on everything. I was watching a recent interview of yours, and you mentioned something called the background music, which I would really love to explore with you in regards to what is the background music. Now, I believe you're referring to kind of the macro environment in regards to the background music and the trends that come forth out of that. Could you maybe elaborate a bit on your kind of background music analogy?
Heavens, background music. What could I be talking about? So there's always background music in my life. Yeah, I find the creative process is enhanced by listening to. When I had an office, I couldn't be in the office. I'd stay at home and I'd play music. But that's not the background music, I guess we're referring to. I don't want to speak ill of particular organizations, but they weren't my favorite.
Yeah,
but so I needed background music because I wasn't getting the edge, you know, because typically it works with, hey, we've got this great analyst and he's coming onto the tape today and he's going to be changing his recommendation on XYZ. And I just want to get you in front of that, you know, can I take an order? I mean, I worked when I came to London, and I promise you, the first objective I was working for, let's leave them nameless, but actually Credit Suisse, because they're no longer with us. Screw them, they're blinking idiots. Credit Suisse Asset Management. And I was assigned to this department. And I'd say to you, I spent, you know, this is one of my stock in trades, but I spent the majority of my time trying to convince people that I was an oxymoron and not a moron. And so the oxymoron, where you put these two contrasting terms together, overlay was that I was more of an inventory manager. And it's like, okay, this is a great idea, but let's call a friend, let's bring up the chart. And this business can be simple. Buy things going up, don't own things going down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We'll come to that in some of the ideas just now. So background music for me, I would be at home, I would be playing music, and I had a chart pornography. I had a technology set up where I had the charts of anything in the world, and I would set it where I get like maybe 15 or 18 seconds, and it would loop. It was like it was porn TV with charts, and I'd begin to observe patterns, and then I'd be able to like screenshot and then identify the kind of clustering of industries, and then I'd think about, well, what is common to them and how are they affected by what's happening in the real world, and then I'd start forming a narrative, and then I'd call my intelligence crew, because you know I employed kids who were smarter than me in particular endeavors, and I said, hey, listen, I'm crazy, but here's what I'm thinking. Why don't you go out and see if you can validate, or even better, come back and tell me I'm a moron. So that was the eclectic process. I think that's the background music.
Yeah, and to sort of expand on that, you've mentioned real opportunities showing up when you have this background music and you have a majority that's positioned against it. Now, I kind of almost feel like we are at a similar point today. You know, that opportunity, I think, is here from a long point of view for the likes of the stock market, gold, and potentially lumping crypto into that. I couldn't really talk on the bond market because I think that that's a very interesting case right now. Yet the headlines are very doom and gloom, and we're going into a recession, you know, there's no way the stock market can do well. But for the past, really since October, it's done the opposite of what the headlines have suggested. Do you feel like perhaps we're in a period right now where the background music is different, the trend is different to what perhaps the majority are seeing.
How is that creating a bromance? I'm liking you more and more as I listen to you.
Thank you. Put this shirt on for you, by the way.
Don't get me started. So what I heard from what you said is that we live every day with this profound paranoia and legitimate concern for the fact that we had like a sudden and explosive acceleration in the year-over-year changes in the prices of goods and services, and wages, nominal wages haven't kept up with that, and we're looking at just a devastating decline in like your real capacity to maintain your previous lifestyle, and people are really concerned. And that comes under this the perimeter of inflation. There is an inflation crisis and a lot of reference to the 1970s. So this is the narrative or the background music. And what's interesting is literally for the last three quarters, despite what? Well, in January, the US Fed came in and they revised their understanding of the US labor market. And they said, wow, there were like almost 500,000 new jobs created, which is an astonishingly large figure. And it would suggest the economy is just booming, going to the moon. And I mean, even in the last meeting from last week or the week before, they were revising higher economic growth, and they're still, you know, they're saying the next meeting is live because they're still concerned about inflation. The Bank of England, of course, has just raised interest rates. And so that is not an auspiciously prosperous, encouraging environment to own a 30-year piece of US government paper. People call them, certificates of wealth confiscation. But where I think you hit upon is that despite all of that, the price is largely unchanged over the last, really since October of last year. And so something like that catches my mind, you know, where there's a trend. Now, it's a flat trend, but it's a trend which does not validate what you read in the financial press. And so that would be something which I would concentrate a lot of my research attention to, understanding the divergence, if you will. I favor long duration US securities. That probably extends itself to British gilts, but treasuries are the riskless security in the global world, and so they're at the top. But I want to say to anyone watching this that in terms of the economy and what we call macro developments, it's a super tanker, and it moves at a super slow speed. I'm always early and I pay an early person tax, which is I get ridiculed a lot. And so I like buying a lot of time, and I can own January 2025. So we've got another 6 months of this year. We've got all of next year. And I just need the thing, you know, I think what it will produce is a positive trend in those bonds. And so I will accrue a profit on the options, and then I will be coming in and physically, if you will, taking a Delta One very large position in the futures in British gilts or US treasuries.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've got a bit of faith in the long term in regards to the central banks perhaps and their continuation of the debt-based system. That might not be the best way to phrase it, that you've got faith in the central banks, but it sounds like you're, and it's very contrary for me to say that, because I've often listened to you say that you think only about five people in the world really understand money, and Jerome Powell and Andrew Bailey are not one.
I mean, okay, like just when like we were getting a great bromance, then you go and spoil it. I think I've got faith in the goons doing central bank policy.
I wouldn't say faith, but I might be totally wrong here, a belief continue to propagate this.
Okay, I'm teasing with you. I believe in a state of irony and paradox. You know, when I, like I said, when I set up a hedge fund in the UK, I'm like, there weren't many, and no one really knew what hedge funds were. We got set up owing to the debacle, the absolute appalling wealth destruction that went on with conventional asset managers running mutual funds or unit trusts. You know, we had the NASDAQ collapse, and the German stock market lost 80% of its value. I was running a European unit trust investing in European equities. I didn't lose any money. Indeed, 1 year I made 3%. And the reaction from the Investment Management Association, trade body, they wanted my fund to be withdrawn from the classification of European equities. And the reason was, it's one thing to lose, 40, 50% of a client's money in 1 year. It's one thing if all of the peers are doing the same, and you can turn around and say, gee, this was just like an asteroid just hit the world. This was a 1 in 100 year type event. We're really sorry, but it's very rare and there's nothing much we can do. And if you look around, like, we all suffered. But if there's one like person like me, and I'm like, screw you guys. Like, I actively managed. I cared about people's wealth. I did everything. I used every permitted technique in the trust, in the same trust documents that you have, you know. And so, and I was talking about irony and paradox. With a hedge fund, you were talking about getting 2% management fee, 20% performance fee, very, very high return, if you will, on intellectual energy or power, which is to say, some of the smartest people in the world presumably would be attracted to that remuneration. And my point was, it's not rational for me to try and outsmart the smartest people on the planet. That's dumb. Okay. And instead, I worked on this notion of irony and paradox, that you're not guaranteed to make money because you are a PhD. Yeah. And you're not guaranteed because strange and capricious things happen in our life. So, to your point, I believe presently that I believe two things. I believe that occasionally you can find an asset class and perhaps individual equity securities where they are deemed to be in the national interest, that the government would like them to succeed. And so if you've got a positive when you're back as that business, the government saying, we love you. You're like, go forward and prosper, right? And that's a good situation. Today, you might apply that to the semiconductor sector.
Yeah, ESG, things like that, yeah.
And obviously, COVID revealed an overdependence on China and Taiwan. And of course, artificial intelligence is requiring so much processing power. And so you might, I'm not saying you should, but you might conceive of a fabricator like Intel, which has been a dreadful business for the last 20 years. But, you know, with its size and stuff, I think the government is kind of behind them and Applied Micro Devices and saying, listen, we're going to give you so many subsidies. Come and build these, $10 billion facilities in Texas, if you will. So that, and I might want to be invested there. So come back to your original comment. I believe actually that the 10-year British gilt and its equivalent worldwide, the Bund and the US Treasury et al., I actually believe that they are the most important asset price in the world today. And my thinking really stems from the shock and the awe and the devastation that we saw back in October when... It's attributed to Liz Truss, the former prime minister, and Kawaga Kawangi, or whatever he was called, the exchequer. I left the system. I live on an island. I'm like, the system. I tried. I was on Question Time. I was on BBC. But you folk are all damn crazy, right? I'm never going to be able to change you. So I left. But the policies that they were pursuing, I think they merit more attention. I think the policies that they're pursuing today are catastrophically bad. The whole Einstein thing, like, it's one thing to make an error, but to keep making the same error, you're just a Philistine. You're an idiot.
The definition of an idiot right there, yeah. It's interesting where the yields are on the gilts now. They blamed Liz Truss for all that, but a lot of the yields for the gilt markets are where they were when they had to step in and actually bail them out, essentially. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, not at all. But what we saw one day back then during that crisis, and so I'm saying I don't think it was, I think it's unfairly attributed to the policies that she was proposing. But I think the true culprit was that it revealed a profound, a gr- grotesque form of investment recommended by experts and consultants. I cannot tell you the contempt I have for the term expert, right? They are experts in getting things wrong, in destroying people's wealth. Okay. But there's this notion of risk parity. So again, background music, we've had zero interest rates for a decade. The very largest financial institutions, pension fund schemes, insurance companies, banks, they changed their behavior and they bought a lot of long duration, which is to say 10-year plus government bonds. And then the consultants came in and they said, you actually reduce your risk if you buy them on leverage. So you reduce your risk if you're a UK pension scheme if you are 15 times what you would normally be, yeah? Because what you're doing, of course, in a world of tiny yields, the 15 is giving you a very high carry, but you end up being very short volatility. And so when something unexpected happened, which was less trust coming, you get the volatility explosion at the surface level, boom. And so we saw something profoundly upsetting, which was on one day, the British yield at 5.3%, you know, the US 10 years about like 3.8 to 4%. And they're terrified that they're effectively accepting the most grotesque levels of unemployment, repossessions, asset prices falling, everything to stop the yields becoming untethered and trading higher and higher. Because if they lose control of the price of long-dated government securities, it's Mad Max, it's Armageddon, everything goes down. I mean, your beautiful crypto will be hung, drawn, and quartered like everything else. You know, gold, absolutely. Yeah, it's going to seem decimated. It will be reduced by 50, 60%. People will sell everything. So I, paradoxically, in this inflation scare world, I really like government bonds because I believe there is no choice but for the policymakers to, if you will, support the price, encourage the price to go higher. But unfortunately, the consequences of those actions are we're going to have the most profoundly nasty economic recession again.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think faith was definitely the right word, the wrong word, sorry. But I actually agree with what you're saying. They have no other choice but to continue to propagate this. And actually, talking about the biggest recession, you know, if you look at the yield curve, for example, the twos and the tens, that's very much suggestive of what you're saying. I just can't help but feel like there is a run for the markets into that.
What do you mean?
So I think everything that you're saying plays out. I think bonds are going to become a very obvious trade all of a sudden again. But I think there's a run for gold, equities, crypto, which is very much tethered with those, into a shitstorm coming down the line that potentially comes on the back end of maybe a reduction in rates. So timing is everything in the markets, no? And you mentioned about being early. And I think the earlier traders typically are the best traders because they have to be wrong for a bit, but then they become very right for a long time. And I think that's what you're saying with the bond market. How do you assess equity markets right now in relation to the background music, I guess, is really what I'm trying to. And when I say equity, I'm really talking about the S&P, the NASDAQ. You could throw gold in there, perhaps, although it's not an equity, of course, it's a commodity and crypto. How do you assess those markets with where they're at right now? Do you think they're just sort of kidding themselves on? Or do you think that, you know, what's your thoughts on all that? That's quite a broad question.
It's a broad question. It's an excellent question. So, you know, I do my gonzo finance every day on Twitter, and I've got Patreons, and I'm trying to guide people how to construct portfolios like pros. Okay. I mean, you know, it's like a Formula One driver. I drove really, really fast because I had really good brakes. What are the brakes? Let's discuss the brakes. You've got to, you should think of the world quadratically, or think of it like a compass with four compass points: north, where are we, west, east. I don't know where I'm in London. And so in this kind of, in the upper left quadrant, let's call it equities in your S&P. Okay. So there just now, I'm very modestly positioned. And believe me, in hedge funds, nothing adds up to 100. If you've got, I did a podcast the other day with a repo guy, and we were saying, like, the average hedge fund with, say, $4 billion of assets of money received from customers, they'll be running about $60 billion in terms of notional risk positions. So, you know, But anyway, let's add up to 100. I'd have no more than 15% invested in, if you will, that S&P quadrant. Where would I be? I'd own the Magnificent Seven, the Bubble Seven. I would own NVIDIA, AMD. I would own
the unicorns.
Unicorns I always kind of associate with the early startups. These are gigantic trillion-dollar companies. But the display, I'm aghast at professional investors when these, again, when they deny very, very powerful, positive, thrusting trends higher, and they call them names like overvalued. You know, NVIDIA, 25 times sales, is grotesquely high, but if it can trade on 25 times sales, you know what? It can trade on 30 times sales, you know?
I always say that. I think that people haven't quite understood how markets work if they think something's overvalued, right?
And let me tell you that you don't just top tick and then collapse, yeah? I mean, if we look at, I mean, I'd upset people if I said there was a bubble in the price of Bitcoin, you know, following the policies from 2020. But, you know, we moved from, correct me, but did we move from about 8,000 or so to 69,000? Is that the kind of...
Yeah, we went all the way down to about 3,000, and then we went to 64, and then there was huge divergences on the way to 69. So that's when things were a bit shaky. So yeah, spot on about that.
So that, you know, that's bubble-like in terms of the thrusting up trend. But it didn't just go 69,000 and then come all the way down to 25,000 in 1 week, you know.
Thereabouts, so, yeah.
You know, it doesn't do that. It peaks and it thrashes around for 6 to 9 months. It falls, it fails to make a new high. It falls again. It rallies and then fails to take out the preceding highs. It can be predictable. So anyway, I'd have 15% of that portfolio there. We move right to the next quadrant, and that would be fixed income. That would be your gilts or, you know, whatever the sovereign nation that you would choose upon. And philosophically and intellectually, that's where I want to have my biggest position. I'm kind of contained presently because it's the best thing that one can say is it's just going sideways. And so I put an asymmetric position there, but that would be, let's call that 60%. Of the portfolio. So we've kind of accounted for 60 and 15 as, you know, 75. The next quadrant is what we call alternatives. And that's where your world exists, crypto. And I'm still uncomfortable saying crypto, you know, to my mind, crypto is a, and forgive me, but crypto is a con and Bitcoin is a commodity, is an asset class. We can challenge you on that in a bit, but that is, so what's in alternatives? Commercial property, index-linked government securities, private equity, gold, Bitcoin. Right? That's $100 trillion. And I would have, so I've got no money left. I'd have 25% of the remaining, if you will, in Bitcoin, in Bitcoin futures.
Okay.
Into the electronic wallet. I'm a trader. Yeah, I want to, like, I'm liquid. I want to change my mind. I'm in, I'm out, I'm trading. But I have 25%. And the reason being is that, first of all, it's suffered mean reversion. Like we said, 69,000 to kind of, let's call it, it was 25,000. I mean, it came all the way down to what, 18,000?
15,000, yeah. 15,000. It's now at 31.
Yeah, yeah. So 69 to 15, washout. I like that. I like mean reversion in asset classes. I never do mean reversion in buying individual stock securities. There's too much idiosyncratic risk. Okay. But my reasoning is in a professional investors will seek to run diversified portfolios, and they will need an alternative asset to put in that sector. Now, I'm in it to win it. If you go into gold, the capitalization of the gold market today is $13 trillion, right? And so if gold were to hit this super incredible hyper bull market and it tripled, well, it would be the same size as the value of all US equities. And that's just beyond my, I've got a wicked and vivid imagination. And for sure, U.S. equity valuations would be falling in that environment. But I still struggle to think of gold being valued at what, 50 times 13, you know, like $40 trillion. And so, and Bitcoin is $0.5 trillion in market worth.
Yep.
Is nothing, right? I mean, it could triple and it'd be $1.5 trillion, which is to say it'd be kind of just a bit bigger than the valuation of NVIDIA. It would be half the valuation of Apple. It'd be, I mean, presently it's 1/26 the value of gold. And so just the law of big or small numbers, I'm like, I kind of like that. And of course, if it was if I was doing this in a hedge fund, I would have purchased all of these assets on margin, right? So if I've got $1 million, I've probably only committed margin of between $50,000 and $100,000. And I'd have the other $900,000 in a money market fund in the States earning 5%.
Yeah.
That's what I am. That's the world of asset capitalism.
Yeah, it's very interesting as well. Talking about Bitcoin, and I'd really like to just maybe move on and finish on your thoughts on crypto generally. But you saw BlackRock enter the spot ETF game for Bitcoin. We've got futures ETFs that are approved. Of course, we know futures don't have to be backed by anything physical or digital in Bitcoin's case, perhaps. And if you look at what they did with gold, I think gold was it a $1 trillion market cap when they got involved in gold? In regards to offering a spot ETF, are we talking 2004 would have been the first gold ETF?
Yeah, probably. So 2004 gold would have been about $400.
Okay.
So it's gone up, what, five times? It's $13 trillion today. So 5 into 13 would be like, it would have been about $2.5 trillion.
$2.5 trillion. And I'm not sure, and you're probably one of the better people to ask about this. I'm not sure, from my take, when BlackRock actually got involved and offered a spot gold ETF, it actually, not only did it bring the spotlight onto gold, but they started pushing it to their clients as part of diversifying, which we know is a very important thing for portfolios. Bitcoin is very similar or on a similar trajectory to that, I believe. I think it's interesting when you talk about gold being, you can't quite see it being a 40, 50, trillion dollar asset class. I think the bond market is always in question with gold, isn't it? Because gold, I've always seen as a hedge against the system. You know, we've got thousands of years of currency. We used sticks in the UK at one point. It's where we get the word tally from. And I think that's quite the gold bugs. That's really their trade, isn't it? Ultimately, is that things go tits up in this sort of traditional financial world with the bond markets. And that money goes from bonds, which is the global bond market, $300 trillion, something along those lines?
Yeah. I mean,
how would you even work that out, you know?
I tell you, well, so global GDP is $100 trillion. You know, the US is $23 trillion. China is now the same size as Europe. So they're both like about $18 trillion. So there's 36 plus 23, call that 40, call that 60, and then throw in the UK, France, and Japan, et al. And so you're $100 trillion. The global assets are $500 trillion.
Yeah.
Normally assets are matched by liability. So if the assets are 5x GDP, then the debt's five times GDP. But more commonly, we would think that the US, British economies are like 3.5 times debt to GDP. So anyways, you're right, actually. $300 trillion. I'm going to endorse that.
I think one of the big gold trades is that they think that the money's going to go out of the sort of debt markets into gold as a kind of questionability comes around. And we've seen a big questionability in regards to the dollar and the system. You know, if you look at, do you think it was a mistake, the US using the dollar as a kind of weapon against Russia?
Well, let me ask you, what would you prefer? Would you prefer they use the dollar or a nuclear bomb?
I would say dollar. That would be my answer. But it's just quite a, should a currency be apolitical? Should a reserve currency not have a side in things? And does that then, if you use it to your side, call into question the whole viability of it being a reserve currency?
Well, is it a unipolar world? Or was this the decision which was very much agreed upon by the Western world? You know, there are only like five tin pot authoritarian regimes, and the events over the weekend just show how vulnerable they are. I mean, your history's against them, logic's against them, time's against them. Okay, and the people who I just don't think it's an issue. Like, hideous regime, this Vladimir Putin, who invades a country, which is pretty much a European country, on the pretext that it's run. I mean, the guy is Jewish and he says, they're, you know, Zelensky or whatever, and he says, we're doing this because of these neo-Nazis. I mean, there has to be financial repercussions for that. Okay. Like, you know, if you're not doing, if you're not coming into the offshore Eurodollar market and freezing things, should we just be buying their oil? Should we just pretend that, you know, nothing's changed? So, you know, there has to be consequences.
Repercussions. Now, yeah. I'm on board with that.
Yeah. Now, there has never been a reserve currency, never. And I'm not quite sure the US dollar is a reserve currency. So that's controversial. People would go back to the hegemon, which was the UK, the biggest sovereign nation that ruled the waves, that ruled the finance world. But sterling only had a value because it was predicated on a lot of confidence that it would be redeemed at fixed and known quantities of gold or silver by any other sovereign nation. The system that we operate today is quite similar, that you have the dollar, but it's, if you will, redeemable by the collateral of the least risky security in the world, which is US Treasury bills. The de-dollarization is, if you read something proclaiming de-dollarization, okay, you are reading from a person who does not understand economics. You know, and that sounds arrogant, but I can categorically tell you that anyone who believes in de-dollarization has zero understanding of the complexities of economics. Okay. And let me try tell you why. The dollar exists, the predominance of the dollar exists really from, I think, a fundamental political error by the Americans at the turn of this century. I think well-spirited, a generous era, and the thinking ran along the lines of, let's welcome and allow China to operate freely alongside us, and that'll do something to humanity. There's a billion plus of these folk, and if you go back 35 years ago, China had the GDP of Turkey.
Yep.
I don't want to put Turkey
extremely small.
And today it's the size of continental Europe. And back then, you know, people lived on a dollar a day kind of thing. So, and now we've got them on $10,000 a year. So, like, for humanity, good. On the other side, of course, that's created a lot of pollution and we've warmed the environment, but, you know, there's another contentious story. But the Chinese, as they've gone through this industrialization, you know, the Chinese in the last 50 years have done what America did in the 19th century, done what South Korea did from kind of 1970 to the present. Okay. They've gone from backward to industrialized powerhouses. And the Chinese chose a policy of doing so by self-investing. And we call that a closed capital account. They don't allow you to invest, or if they do, it's very prescribed and very, very small. But a country which is industrializing is pretty cool. Like, the investment returns on being the first entrepreneur to open the first railway line or the first chemical line or even the second, third, fourth, fifth, the returns are high. So you have a mountain of very attractive investment opportunities, but it's typically greater than the amount of available savings. Now, when America was industrializing in the 19th century, the solution was to run trade deficits and for the UK and the rest of the world to provide the surplus savings and therefore the investment. And it kind of worked out pretty well. That doesn't happen. That does not happen in China. They run every year a current account surplus, a trade surplus in manufacturing. Okay. And so all of the money that they kind of, they don't confiscate, but they deny wealth to their citizens by preventing the currency from appreciating. So people just don't realize that over those 35 years, since 1994, when the US signed the NAFTA free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, Chinese currency has devalued from modestly, but from 6.5 to 7.3 today. Now, in economics, and this is why I was very adamant that anyone says, a de-dollarization is going to happen. They don't understand. This should not happen in economics. The renminbi should be strong, right? You should require 4 CNY to buy one US dollar. You require 7.3. If it was 4, Chinese folk would be richer. And guess what? Like, when you make poor people a bit richer, like we saw during COVID, what did they do? They buy stuff. And they would buy stuff from us. We live in a world which has this profound deficit of demand and a profound surplus of savings. So we live in a world where we wished, when Clinton was signing the thing, we were hoping that they would be richer. Tick. As you become more prosperous, you're less prone to like political kind of gobbledygook.
Yep.
Like these Communist Party. You're more like, hey, you know, really, you know. And the sum of trade between the two countries would benefit both. But China doesn't buy goods and services from the UK. I mean, it does, but like not in the proportion that would
limited. Yeah.
Likewise with the US. What it does buy is it buys financial assets. And so we live at a time, and I think a lot of the hopes and aspirations for your sector in this alternative crypto world is what is the hope and expectation of it is that the trade structure just now inflates asset prices, house prices, right? And so the young folk are like, I'm looking at my parents and I'm thinking, and I'm looking at my life and I'm thinking, I'm never going to be as rich as my parents. Yeah. And that's kind of a form of Marxism where you start to reject the system and you believe that it's now plateaued, that you'll never succeed. And so you're into redistribution. And that's kind of Marxism. Or you say, I'm doubling down. I need a good asset. I need something. You say to someone, what's your nearer? I think the crypto police are coming to arrest
maybe.
Me. I need something that's going to double, triple. Yeah, I'm saying I'm in it to win it. Can gold triple? Maybe, but I don't think so. Can it triple? Can it go up 4 times? Yeah, it can. And I think that's what's powering a lot of your people, because otherwise they're looking at a world where they can't afford anything and everything's overvalued.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And maybe I'm very mindful of your time. We could finish off on crypto. It sounds like you see a merit in Bitcoin, but perhaps not the crypto space, you know, of which there are 8,000 cryptos now. You perhaps don't see merit in those. And I think Bitcoin is very different from...
What is it? You said there's 8,000 cryptos. What is a crypto? Is that a coin?
A blockchain is really the technology behind this. So you had Bitcoin. Whenever anyone asks me about crypto, I always explain the lineage. You had Bitcoin that was created by Satoshi Nakamoto, perhaps divine intervention. Perhaps there's a hidden agenda there, just like maybe there was with the internet. Who knows? I'm not here to speculate on that. But I think it's very interesting. He combined cryptography with blockchain to come up with basically a unit of accounting that anyone could verify, anyone could take part in, and that had a fixed supply. And then he left that. Then you had Ethereum that came around and they said, this is really interesting, Bitcoin. You've got a solid framework, which is the blockchain. Let's add an extra layer of capability so that you can do more than just send your crypto to a wallet, which is smart contracts, which essentially are a contract that is sealed and executed by the blockchain itself. Now, this is the really interesting thing with cryptos. And I understand why people think that crypto is a scam and Bitcoin's the, you know, this whole Bitcoin maximalist idea. And I agree that Bitcoin's very separate. But, and a question for you is, did you take part in the dot-com boom?
I'm a professional speculator. And I told you at the beginning, I buy things going up and I sell things going down.
Of course.
And so, of course I did, yeah.
And did you view that as, did you think there was something more to this technology that was the internet, or did you just see it as an investment opportunity?
The hardest thing and the most professional thing you can do is to invest without prejudice.
Yep. Invest. I agree.
I buy things going up and I sell things going down, and I try and find those securities through the labyrinth of my mind and the background music of what's happening. You know, the charts tell you, like, if you go to a new city, I typically dine in a busy restaurant. I walk past empty restaurants. So the bums on seats actually has a knowledge.
Yep.
Yeah. So let me expand upon what you were saying and try and embarrass myself with my limited knowledge. Okay. But what I don't understand is, why can't we coalesce around one coin and call it Bitcoin? okay, first of all. And then with that Bitcoin, and this is where I may fool myself, but like, and mix these terms of blockchain and Ethereum, why can't we have this super fusion of the three? Okay, because with that, you know, I run a lot of property, again, like people don't like me already, they really don't like me, but you know, my St. Bart's properties, I'm leveraged. I got like $9 million of debt. I can't tell you how painful it is to arrange that debt. And why is it painful? Why does it take so long? Because there's a lack of trust. Yeah. And it's so hard to, when thing goes, if it goes wrong and I can't pay, it's an impossibly long time to retrieve the asset and move on and clear the market. And I promise you not, right? This is a true story, is what I want to say. I had to write in with pen and hand and ink and paper. As you know, like when you're naughty, like you've got to write this 20 to 100 times, I will not, you know, do it again. I had to write in flowery French language the most preposterous thing that, you know, I promised to pay you the money, but it was 150 characters. Words and in preposterously silly French language. I love French language. This was preposterously Shakespearean. And I kept making an error and it kept being rejected and I had to write it again and again. I spent 3 hours. I mean, I nearly blew my brains out. Okay. That all go, and then the paper, it's photocopied a million times. They need physical storage. There must be half of France that's storing this stuff. You know, like if you're in the States and you do a credit card thing and you get that silly piece of like photocopy paper, you have to keep 5 years of that. The ink disappears after like 2 months. But if the feds come in and do an audit, right, and you don't have that piece of paper with the invisible ink, yeah, right. So there is so much value in having a currency unit with the Ethereum and the blockchain and all forged together. And I'm down with it. That's a great idea. I don't know if I just, does that make me a maximalist? I don't know what this term is. I know you've got that ass sailor out there who's, you know, he's a glorious, wonderful speaker and he's a really, really intelligent engineer. But he doesn't have my knowledge about markets and economics.
We're both chart guys, right? If you want to know about Michael Saylor, look at his company and look at what that has done, right?
I'm not here to put him down. So where am I there? Tell me, I just gave you my, and I'm really tight now on time.
We'll get this wrapped up.
Am I wrong? Where am I wrong in that?
Hugh, you understand what's going on here far better than most. You just haven't quite connected all the pieces of the puzzle. So very quickly on the comment on scammers, you get scammers in all industries. There's nothing actually, it's not crypto that's scamming people, it's people. And actually it's often facilitated via social media and the kind of Web 2 world that don't implement enough barriers for these things to take place. Sure. FTX was a total shit show. You've got to remember Sam Bankman-Fried was rubbing shoulders with the likes of Bill Clinton. All of these people. Binance is not a scam. Binance have honored every single withdrawal that's ever came about. Yes, they've been charged with the SEC, but I'm going to say this right now.
They're going down. They will not exist.
I will stand with CZ and say that actually, and this perhaps we can, if we do another interview, if you don't think I'm completely crazy in the future, we can see where they are. But they've honored every single withdrawal that's taken place. The SEC don't like them because they're not a US company.
I tell you what we should do. Let's end here.
Yep.
I think this is a great point to end because it's suspense. And let's do another one.
Yes.
Okay. And we'll do it like you put this out and then within a week, we'll put the next one out. Okay. Yep.
I would love to do that. And we can look at crypto and I'd love to answer your questions on what's going on here.
I really want to hear it. I want to hear your Binance thing. And I think we can have a good chat there. I like you. Let's do it.
Fantastic. Hugh, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, my friend. You know, you're a contrarian and that is you. You know, there's so many interesting things that we've spoken about, and I'm really looking forward to get you back on and we can speak a little bit more in depth about the crypto space specifically. But a massive thank you for sharing your thoughts, your views, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here.